I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. Novel coronavirus was discovered last December after an outbreak in Wuhan, China, thought to originate at a seafood market that's been shut down. More than 1,000 Chinese have died from the virus and tens of thousands have been infected. There have been cases identified in other countries, including 13 in the United States, according to the CDC. Public health officials are on alert about the possible spread of this infectious disease that the World Health Organization has named COVID-19. Coming up, why we tend to underestimate and overestimate risk and end up worrying about the wrong things. But first, we ask Stephen Alice to join us. He's Director of Disease Control at the Philadelphia Department of Public Health. And Stephen Alice, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty. Happy to be here.
Nice to have you with us. Any confirmed cases in Philadelphia?
No, not as of yet.
And any cases that you are looking at that are under investigation?
We've had a few. Yeah, we have had people that have met case definition and we've tested them, but they've come back negative thus far.
Would you say then anyone living in the Philadelphia area, there's a low risk of contagion?
I think right now it's a very low risk to people in Philadelphia. We haven't identified any cases yet. We haven't identified any cases in Pennsylvania or New York City or New Jersey. And so for our region right now and the whole country, there's very few cases have been detected. And so the risk right now here is low. But we want to keep it that way. So I'll just emphasize that the public health posture right now here in the States and in other countries around the world besides China is heightened awareness for detection and containment. So that's our posture right now.
Well, let's talk about detection and then we'll talk about containment. What should folks do when they think about detection?
Well, so right now, it's the risk of contracting this disease and having it show up here in the United States is really all connected to travel, particularly travel to China, and even more specifically, travel to Hubei province, which is the province where Wuhan City is, where most of the cases have been occurring.
And containment? I mean, containment.
Yeah, so containment, you know, there's no medication or treatment to give to people that have the disease to help them get better faster. So it really is all about identifying suspect cases when they're symptomatic and confining them, keeping them away from other people so they can't spread the disease. And then for us to know about contacts, people that may have been exposed to cases, and to keep them separated and under surveillance, watching to see if they develop symptoms. And if they do, then we test them and see if they in fact have the novel coronavirus, then they become a case, and we look at contacts around those people.
And what are the symptoms?
The symptoms are, it's a combination of fever, but that's not always present in a lot of cases. In fact, new research just came out about 1,100 cases from China, and it showed that 44% of patients upon presentation had fever. 88% of them developed fever on their hospitalization. But so fever sometimes, and then cough or other signs of respiratory distress, like shortness of breath, those kinds of things are the predominant clinical features.
I realize this is a new virus, but what do we know about it so far?
Yeah, so coronaviruses is a class of viruses we have known about for quite a while. Some of them cause common colds every year here in the States, don't really kill a lot of people. But there have been other coronaviruses that have caught a lot of attention over the last couple of decades, SARS particularly, and then MERS-CoV. And so when a new evolving coronavirus comes from an animal source, like has occurred with this novel coronavirus, it's different. It can behave differently with respect to its transmissibility, how easily it spreads from person to person, and severity, how sick it makes an individual and potentially how many people it might kill.
Thinking about the people who have died so far, and most of them are in China, do we know why this particular group of people were at greater risk for this virus?
So we have to look at data that's coming out of China to tell us more information about the people who have gotten severely ill, been hospitalized in the ICU, and those who have died. And what we're seeing is that it's mostly older people, 60 years of age and older, but not exclusively, and then people with other underlying health conditions like chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, heart disease, diabetes, things like that. Those people tend to do worse and are dying. But that doesn't apply to all the deaths. So in some ways, this novel coronavirus is very similar to seasonal influenza because here, every year, every winter, those are the people that tend to do worse with influenza and potentially die from it.
And I do want to get to the seasonal influenza and just talk about, you know, the numbers of cases and who is at risk. Mm-hmm. But I'm curious about this novel coronavirus. And I should say that the World Health Organization has a name for it, COVID-19. Mm-hmm. How contagious is it? Do we know?
Yeah, so we're learning more and more as there are more cases and investigations and interviews happen among those cases with respect to who they were around, what their exposures may have been. We get a better picture of how easily transmissible it is. And it is person-to-person transmission now, and so it still is presumed to be primarily droplet-mediated. And what that means is through sneezing, coughing, even talking, droplets from your mouth come out or nose if you sneeze, and that contains viral particles. And if you're within a close proximity to somebody doing that, within 6 feet, say, that's kind of the measure that we're hearing, then you could be contaminated with those virus particles and you have to infect a mucous membrane of your own, like your eyes or your nose, and then that's how you get infected. So that's primarily the route of transmission that we're seeing and that we think is happening with this novel coronavirus. Again, similar to seasonal influenza transmission.
Do face masks work? We're seeing more pictures of people wearing face masks.
Face masks do have a role, and I would say surgical type of face masks, which aren't really tight-fitting, have a tight air seal. Those kinds of surgical masks, we call them, are good for what we call source control. So if you're somebody that potentially has symptoms or is incubating the virus, wearing a surgical mask helps you prevent from spreading virus into the environment. So, you know, if I'm sick with it, say, and I've got a mask on and I cough or sneeze, those viral particles aren't going out into the environment around me or onto surfaces nearby or other people. So those kinds of masks can help with that. There are higher level kinds of protective equipment, respirator masks that healthcare workers typically use for other things like tuberculosis that do have more of an airtight seal around their nose and mouth. That's to protect the healthcare worker who is not sick with the disease when they're interacting in close proximity to somebody that might have the virus.
And washing hands. I think we all know that you're supposed to spend something like 2 minutes thoroughly washing your hands, whether it's coronavirus or not. And I'm curious, Stephen, Alice, do people do this?
Well, washing hands is huge because, you know, like I say, you just touch an object that somebody had sneezed on or talked near, and there are viral particles or bacteria on those contaminated surfaces, like a doorknob. You can pick a virus that way and then touch yourself. So washing your hands, washing virus and bacteria off your hands frequently is a very good thing to do, particularly during winter when those kinds of pathogens are circulating more frequently. But I would like to mention seasonal influenza, you know, it is something we see every year. It's a serious disease. We track hospitalizations due to influenza in Philadelphia and deaths that are reported to us. And I'll tell you that right now, so far this year, we've had 605 hospitalizations reported to us and 10 people have died. Mm-hmm. 2 years ago, it was a very severe seasonal influenza year. And that year, we had 1,500 hospitalizations and 52 people died. So that's a real risk. And so if I can, I would just like to say this novel coronavirus, while we're trying to keep it at bay, really should have us address and think about our own strategy to control the spread of infectious diseases and viruses for ourselves and our community. And so covering your cough, sneezing or coughing into your elbow to not shed virus out into the environment, getting a seasonal flu vaccine, that's something that's available to everybody every fall. And so really looking at those kinds of things, staying home if you're sick is another real good one, too, that will keep people from spreading contagious diseases to others.
How do you think, though, the coverage of this novel coronavirus has kind of fed some of the, if not hysteria, then overreaction? Someone was telling me that they were riding the train and they heard someone saying very loudly on their telephone, you know, don't go to Chinatown, don't talk to Chinese people for fear that you're going to get the coronavirus. This is absolutely incorrect when it comes to Philadelphia, but how much of just the overall coverage of this has fed a kind of a misinformation?
Yeah. So, you know, I won't comment to what the news covers and what the public reaction to that news might be and how valid it is. But, you know, it is a new evolving infectious disease that we didn't previously have. And so there is concern, I would say, with respect to, you know, what is this virus going to do in the coming weeks and months? How far will it spread around the world? Will we be able to contain it and stop it from entering into our communities here in the United States? We don't really know the answers to that. Given that we're looking at a 1.4 to maybe 2% case fatality rate with this virus, we'll have to see. And so it might be that months from now, you know, it's been managed and it kind of goes away. But then the concern, what will happen next winter? We really don't know if this is something that will take on more of a seasonal reemergence, you know, with each coming winter season. So there is concern, I would say, about things like that. But again, there are things folks can do. And, you know, we talked about staying home when you're sick, hand washing, getting seasonal flu vaccine. Those are important things.
Sure. I wonder if there are lessons from the SARS virus that was about 10 years ago that can be applicable, at least so far, when it comes to novel coronavirus.
Yeah, there are some lessons that SARS taught us. And I think what we saw there was a higher level of transmission among healthcare workers. And so the level of personal protective equipment and the steps that healthcare workers take to put on that equipment and take it off and to wash their hands and do proper infection control, that's really been enhanced. And so, you know, we know that here in Philadelphia, our healthcare facilities have robust personal protective equipment, training programs, and materials that they take their staff through. So to avoid healthcare workers and protect healthcare worker safety.
We have about a minute before I have to say goodbye to you. I know that Mayor Kenney went to Chinatown to have a meal with others because reportedly business is down in Chinatown.
Okay.
I realize you're a public health person, but nonetheless, it does have economic consequences.
That may be. You know, right now, all I can say is the risk of novel coronavirus in Philadelphia is, you know, to the extent that we know, it's zero or very, very low. We haven't detected it. We have a lot of activities right now in surveillance, and so we're really looking for it.
And when you say surveillance, would this be people coming into hospitals complaining of certain symptoms?
Yeah, so hospitals and healthcare providers are all ready and know to assess every patient that comes in right now for symptoms that are consistent with this disease, so fever, cough, other signs of respiratory distress, and recent travel to China, or exposure to somebody confirmed with the disease. Now, we don't really have anybody like that here in this region.
Right.
So they're all doing that at the start of a patient presentation. And so those people are being isolated, reported to us, and then we're hearing the story to confirm whether or not testing is appropriate or not.
Well, I appreciate you joining us today in Radio Time. Stephen Ellis, thanks so much.
Okay.
And
you're
very welcome. He's Director of Disease Control at the Philadelphia Department of Public Health. Coming up, why we tend to overestimate and underestimate risk and end up worrying about the wrong things. Stay with us. We've got two guests waiting in the wings. Much more after this short break. We'll be right back. This is
supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne, and we've been talking about the coronavirus. Just said goodbye to Philadelphia's Director of Disease Control at the Department of Public Health, who said there are no identified cases in the city. Meanwhile, the CDC reports that 22 million Americans got the seasonal flu this year. 210,000 were hospitalized. 12,000 have died, including 78 children. Well, that got us thinking about our ability to understand and respond to risk and why we tend to worry about the wrong things. We have two guests who have joined us. Here in our Philadelphia studios is Sudeep Bhatia. He's a professor of psychology and marketing at the University of Pennsylvania. And Sudeep, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Very happy to be here.
You're very welcome. And joining us by Skype, I do believe, is David Ropeek. He's an instructor at Harvard, a consultant on risk perception and risk communication, author of a book called How Risky Is It Really? Why Our Fears Don't Always Match the Facts. And David, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Good morning. Skype it is.
Professor, Skype it
good
is.
Good morning.
Okay, that's good. Sometimes you never know. Yep. But no, we're happy to have you here. Let me just, Sudeep, let me just put a question to you because you were listening in as I was talking to the health commissioner, I should say, director of disease control at the Department of Public Health in Philadelphia. You were listening in as I was talking to him about the coronavirus. There are no cases identified in the city, which raises the question about just how concerned, how vigilant, how should we be thinking about this as we go about our daily lives?
Well, here's what the director of disease control ended his segment with, right? He said, to the extent that we know, it is very, very low risk. So when he uses words like very, very low risk, I guess we can infer that the probability is small. This is not something to be particularly concerned about. Now, as psychologists, we know that the amount of attention that we pay to low risk is disproportionately high. So we, you know, when we try and perceive these risks and when we make decisions based on these risks, we overestimate these probabilities, and perhaps we are a little bit more responsive to the possibility of, say, getting coronavirus than we should be.
I want to get back to that. David, let me get you in on the conversation. I don't want to spend the whole hour on the coronavirus because as much we don't know. But nonetheless, how do you see how this emerging new virus has been covered and how this sort of challenges our perceptions about risk?
It's a good teaching moment, so we can talk about other risks, but this is a good teaching moment. So there is 50 years of research by Paul Slovic and Baruch Fischoff and Melissa Finucane and a lot of other people that have identified essentially the underlying psychology that explains what Professor Bhatia was talking about. Risk is a feeling, as Paul Slovic has put it. It has very little to do with the numbers, very little to do with the facts, in fact. It has mostly to do with how we feel about those facts. And what those professors and researchers have discovered is a set of, they've named them, I'll call them risk perception factors or psychological characteristics that we all seem to share that tend to make things in general, like the coronavirus at the moment, COVID-19, scarier or less scary. So let's talk about a couple just so that I can crystallize this idea,
please,
if I
do.
May. So when a risk is new, it's scarier. And they think that the reason for that is that inherently we feel safer when we feel like we have some control. Think about driving the car with your eyes open or your eyes closed, right? When you know stuff about what's going on, you feel safer because you are empowered. Empowered, critical word, control, empowered, right? So when something is new, by definition, there's stuff we don't know. We haven't lived with it like regular flu. We haven't seen that it comes and goes, and most of us survive, although a lot of us do die, and flu is very serious. But new means unknown, which means powerlessness. And regardless of the very low transmissibility of this disease, even among people who are in Wuhan, unless you're trapped on a cruise ship and everybody's transmitting it around, regardless of the low transmissibility, regardless of the 2-3% mortality, which is lower than normal flu, those numbers aren't what matters. Our powerlessness does. That's how risk works. It's a feeling more than the facts.
And hold on to that thought because I want to get Sudeep back in on the conversation. But if we're talking about probability and we're talking about math, that tends to be something that's very dispassionate. And yet we are people, you know, we have emotions and emotions often drive our decision making and our sense of vulnerability and risk.
Well, as I say, the research.
Yeah, I'm sorry, David. Hold on. Just, okay, let me get Sudeep back and then I'll get you back. But yeah, hold on.
Yes, go ahead. Sorry.
Sure.
No, these are all very good points. So these are numbers ultimately. But we have emotional responses to these numbers. The thing that I like about numbers is you can do a little bit of math with them.
You
know the right way of making a risky decision. This is something that has been studied in mathematics and philosophy and psychology and economics for many, many centuries. So how do you make a good risky decision? Well, you simply take the probabilities and you multiply them against the consequences or the payoffs in order to get the expected value of the risk. So if you're playing a gamble, right, you're playing the lottery, say the Mega Millions, there's a probability of winning. There's a payoff of winning. You multiply the two together to get some kind of monetary estimate of the value of that gamble. Now, turns out that people don't do it, but of course, casinos and public health agencies and financial institutions are able to do this. People have very systematic errors that cause them, in some cases, to overestimate these probabilities, right? When you think about the probability of winning the Mega Millions jackpot, right? So someone just won it about, I think yesterday, $202 million.
That's a lot of money. Okay.
What's the probability? Well, the probability, I did a little bit of a rough calculation before the show. It is 0.00000005. Your mind cannot represent the smallness of that number. So what happens is that the possibility of winning this jackpot tends to be overestimated. The number looms larger in your mind than it really should. And because of that, you think that the lottery is a good gamble to take. But as we all know, it's not a good gamble.
You're
to
mostly
take.
Going to lose. I mean, except for that one lucky person.
Absolutely.
But just a quick follow up, and then David, I'll get you back in on the conversation. But, you know, we human beings, we have lucky numbers, and we are feeling lucky today, and we have this sense of either our good fortune or our bad fortune, which often figures into our decision making.
Yeah, absolutely. So you know, you can imagine in the case of coronavirus, people have these unlucky feelings as well, which could be caused by a number of interesting but ultimately irrelevant contextual factors. Okay, maybe a black cat walks in front of you. Well, you know, that's
hard.
That's you know, that could be perceived by some to be a bad omen. Now, it turns out that scientifically speaking, there's a very small probability of getting the coronavirus, and the probability doesn't change if you're, say, you know, in a context where you feel unlucky. Obviously, in the case of a lottery,
sure,
there's a very small probability of winning the lottery, and that probability probably doesn't change based on how lucky you're feeling that day.
Let me go back to you, Dave. And you were talking about, especially with the coronavirus, because it is new, there are things we don't understand about it. And we have this sense that we are not in control, I guess, in terms of what to do if we get this virus, which is, you know, in the United States is extremely, extremely, extremely rare. How, though, do we bring some kind of rationality into our decision making?
Forgive me, but rationality is a poisonous word.
Okay, fair enough.
Because this whole conversation so far has implied that we can be rational.
Right.
And by rational, the poisonousness of the word implies that we could be fact-based and objective. And all the cognitive science says we just can't.
We're not built that way?
We take the facts we have and we filter them through who we are and whether a black cat just walked by. And do we have any experience with SARS the last time or West Nile virus or a whole ton of how we actually live? Our perceptions are all subjective. Our perceptions are all filtered through facts, usually not all of them. Usually not with the skill to understand all of them. There's a whole body of science called enumeracy. Like, we're bad with words, we're bad with numbers too, as Professor Badiou was talking about. We filter the few facts we have through what tools we have to make a quick judgment about how to stay safe. All our perceptions are subjective. So to say, how do we get rational is, I would rephrase it if I may, Marty. How do we make a better, healthier choice for ourselves? That's how in my writing I try to put it, because I don't like to judge people as right or wrong or smart or stupid. That's condescending and ignores what the research tells us about how people think. But we can, as Professor Badiou said, get more facts from sources that seem neutral, trustworthy, reliable. And in this social media era, that's harder to do, and use more of the facts. And the other thing we can do, and then I'll wrap up this soliloquy, forgive me, is we can realize, and this is why I like to teach all this stuff, that our feelings sometimes get in the way of what is the healthier choice. It's built in. We're stuck with it. I do it too. I understand the psychology, but I still make these mistakes. But I understand that those mistakes can be bad for me. I understand that if it's new and I freak out, that's not necessarily going to lead to the best choice. I can be aware of my own foibles as I also try to add facts into my decision making, and that will lead to a closer representation of what you imply with rational or critical thinking and healthier choices.
Let me just quickly reintroduce the two of you. That's David Ropeek, and he's an instructor at Harvard. He's also a consultant in risk perception, risk communication, author of a book called How Risky Is It Really? How Our Fears Don't Always Match the Facts. And Sudeep Bhatia is with us here in our Philadelphia studio. He's a professor of psychology and marketing at the University of Pennsylvania. We are talking about our irrational brain, how our emotions can cloud our thinking and our decision making, and frankly, what we can do about it. You can join our conversation. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Sudeep, let me give you a chance to respond to David, who's saying that, you know, we're people and we are driven by our emotions, and that, yes, we can educate ourselves, and that helps us to make decisions, hopefully in our own benefit. But I'd just be curious about what your response is to David's description of human beings and our thinking.
Well, he raises a number of very important and very accurate points, right? So one is that we are emotional creatures. When we think about a coronavirus, we have a much, much more emotionally laden response than when we think about, say, driving a car.
Right.
Of course, the probability of getting into a car accident is I would guess slightly higher than that of getting the coronavirus. So there's a mismatch between the raw statistics and our emotional responses. The other thing that David brought up, which I think is very important, is the idea of subjective probability. So mm-hmm. how does our mind figure out the probabilities that we want to use in these kinds of calculations? Well, one cue that it relies on, that's something that I believe you want to talk about, is how often it hears about the word or the concept. In our case, how often we hear about the coronavirus in media. And so this is something that we'll probably get back to in a few minutes, but that's a very, very important aspect of risk perception.
And is it just broadly speaking the media, the coverage of it, or is it the more sort of heightened coverage of it that feeds into some of this anxiety?
Well, let's take the perspective of one of your listeners. So they're maybe in their car in the highway. It's 10:30 a.m. and they are hearing about coronavirus for a whole hour.
Exactly.
Okay. Well, the afternoon and the evening when they go to bed, coronavirus will be still lingering in their mind. Now, even if they don't objectively believe that the coronavirus is a extremely risky thing, the fact that it is salient will cause them to behave in ways as if that reflect in some sense an overreaction to the risk of coronavirus.
Because chances are they're also going to hear more in the afternoon before they get home tonight. David, let me get you in on the conversation. And I have to say, we were frankly reluctant to talk about coronavirus on Radio Times because while it is a new virus and there are concerns, no cases in Philadelphia. The CDC has identified, I think, 13 cases in the United States. Is we wanted to find, that right way of talking about it that educates people without alarming them unnecessarily.
So there is a problem, as Professor Bhatia was referring to, which you can largely think of as your consciousness radar screen. So only so much fits on it. I think you alluded to this earlier in your program, Marty. So we can only be consciously aware of so much stuff at any given time. And risk is one big part of it because we want to stay alive. So those blips about risk tend to grab a pretty active spot on our risk radar screen. There was a shooting, climate change, let's use other examples, right? Sure. So if there is a dominant blip on our radar screen, the hour of coronavirus, 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 and you're not hearing about climate change, climate change, climate change, right? What does your radar screen look like? And this is not consciousness.
Sure.
This is subconscious. Right. So it's the kind of stuff that brews in your kind of lazy, easier jump to conclusions brain that does most of our reacting to the world. The purposeful thinking and rationality is, we have a great capacity for it, but it comes second and it's harder to do when we do less of it. So it's actually has a name in the cognitive studies, and it's called the availability heuristic. Heuristic's a fancy academic word for mental shortcuts. The louder something screams in your consciousness, the more dominant it's going to be in your thinking, and the numbers, once again, are less important than that feeling.
The numbers are less. Well, go ahead, Sudeep.
No, I absolutely agree. And it's true that when humans make decisions, the numbers are less important than what is screaming in their minds. In this case, it'll be coronavirus. I believe there's a very nice comparison to be made by with another health risk, and that's the risk of heart disease. So 1 in 7 Americans will die of health disease, roughly.
Heart disease, yep.
Sorry, heart disease, yeah. Mm-hmm. Slightly less than 2 Americans die every minute of heart disease. So, you know, in the past 20 minutes that we've been on, a number of people have tragically died. Now, here's the thing. If you go online right now on Google News and search for the number of hits that you get for heart disease on Google News, you'll find that that's 77 million. The number of hits that you get for coronavirus, 307 million.
Wow.
Okay, roughly 4 times as much. So this tells us that coronavirus is 4 times as accessible. Right, David used the word accessibility heuristic. That's a very, very important term. It's 4 times more accessible, roughly, than heart disease. But of course, it's nowhere near as fatal as heart disease. So there are numbers, certainly. People don't use the right numbers, and that's partially because our society doesn't reflect the importance of risks in a manner that's proportional to the numbers.
Do you think that's...
Let me add one.
Yeah, go ahead, David. Yeah, go ahead. And we got about a minute before we have to take a break. But go ahead.
Yes,
yeah, go ahead, David.
When you ask whether the media is responsible for this, they play a role in that accessibility or availability, as I've read it named. But they're not the only thing. What are friends talking about?
Sure.
There's a whole theory called the social amplification of risk, where you hear about it lots of different ways, and that leads to behaviors that add to your risk. And that's really the important point of this conversation I hope we get to after the break, is so we can comment on whether this is rational or not, but so what, right? What we really want to encourage here is people making healthier choices. And the variety of ways that we hear about things, and in this social media world, there are tons of them that aren't the news media that add to that accessibility.
Well, let's take that short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation with our guest. That's David Ropeik, and he's an instructor at Harvard. He's also a consultant in risk perception and communication, wrote a book called How Risky Is It Really? Why Our Fears Don't Always Match the Facts. Sudeep Bhatia with us here in our Philadelphia studios, and he's a professor of psychology and marketing at the University of Pennsylvania. And we want to hear from you. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can pick up the phone and join the conversation. That phone number, 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne talking with Sudeep Bhatia and David Ropeik about risk and our rational, irrational brains, how our emotions can cloud our thinking when it comes to decision-making. Sudeep, you wanted to talk a little bit about what happened after September 11th, that tragic day when so many people were killed in New York and in Western PA and also in Washington, D.C.
Yes. So it was, of course, a very tragic day. I think 9/11 also stands out as being a highly emotional and highly salient event in people's lives. I mean, if I ask you right now, you'll be able to tell me where you were.
Sure.
When you heard.
I can see it.
Yep. And everyone can. And for an older generation, it was the assassination of JFK. But this is a very salient and very emotion-laden event. And as David mentioned, these emotions and salience influence our abilities to make risk judgments. So after 9/11, the number of people taking flights dropped by about 15%. That led to an increase in the number of people driving, which led to an additional 1,600 deaths in the year following 9/11. Or that's an estimate. It's also very tragic, but I think it again captures how emotion, control, salience, accessibility, all of these causes to make certain types of risky decisions that could have a perverse effect on our safety and on our well-being.
That's such an important a point there. But David, I wonder just, we live in anxious times. It's not the first time human beings have lived in anxious times. But I wonder just when people are fearful and feel uncertain, you were talking about this sort of issue of control and newness. How much does that then feed the kind of anxiety that comes with trying to make a decision that's in one's good best interest?
There are two aspects to that, and it's very important. The first is when we're more worried than we need to be, based on what the evidence says, though there may be real valid emotional reasons to feel that way, that biologically becomes chronic stress. Mm-hmm. And when we are stressed, getting down way down into the biological weeds here, we are in a mini fight or flight or freeze response. We've turned up the systems we need to survive, and we've turned down the systems that we don't. When that persists, chronic stress, more than a couple weeks, this is the work of Robert Sapolsky and Bruce McEwen, who just passed away, and a bunch of people, it's really bad for our health. Our heart rate is higher. Our immune system is weaker. We're more likely to get sick or sicker. Chronic stress does a whole lot of bad stuff for us. So keeping risk in perspective, understanding that your emotions are clouding a more reasoned judgment is a really good way to stay healthier. The second point, though, is there is a theory called the mean world syndrome. It was posited by George Gerbner, who was of Pennsylvania, University of Pennsylvania. He's passed away too, which says that if all we hear about the world is that it's a bad place, or a threatening place, or don't go to Chicago because you get shot there. You don't go to Chicago. If all you hear about airplanes is that they crash, you drive. When we think that the world is a scarier place than it is, we behave accordingly. We treat people differently. We choose to live in gated communities. We become racist and bigoted towards people that we stereotype as being a threat. The mean world syndrome is in and of itself a stressor and really radically changes our behavior for the worst. And both of these are fed by outbreaks like coronavirus when, they're always going to come along. But keeping them in perspective is really bad, important for our health.
Well, and I was also reading about something, Sudeep, that's called the infodemic problem, which is that you've got an epidemic or the possibility of an epidemic, but then you've got the infodemic, which is the misinformation, the conspiracy theories, the racism, all the bad stuff that can come from getting the wrong kind of information.
Yeah, absolutely. So again, some people are good at being able to discern which of these information sources are accurate, others less so. And of course, we didn't evolve when you think about, what our minds are capable of doing, these are a product of our evolution to a large extent. We didn't evolve in an environment where we had a number of different, oftentimes contradictory information sources, all of them fighting for our attention. We also didn't evolve in an environment in which we had very small probabilities. Mm-hmm. We did, interestingly.
It was more life and death, right?
It was more life and death, or more specifically, there were obviously small probability events, like you could be hit by lightning on the savannah, but we didn't have enough exposure to those events to be able to learn about the probabilities and then reason, again, rationally or optimally with those probabilities. When we're talking about our evolution, I think a very nice topic also involves group decision making, or in-group and out-group bias. In this case, coronavirus does normalize to some extent a certain type of public health driven xenophobia. I'm not saying that it's wrong to say ban entry into the United States of people who've been to China or Chinese people. That is certainly the correct public health measure, but it does, again, normalize the idea that we can exclude some people from our country for the purposes of health and safety.
For health and safety. David, do you want to respond to that?
Yeah, the infodemic thing, broadly, if I may, to add on to what Professor said and to answer your question, Marty, gets back to this theory that Roger Kasperson and other people posited called the social amplification of risk. So we are tribal beings. We evolved in groups. We don't go it alone. When the lion attacks, if we're alone, the lion wins. Together, we've got a shot. So we're acutely sensitive to what others around us are doing. If you go out on the street and you have a group of people with you and you all spontaneously look up, guess what everybody else around is going to do?
Yes.
Right. Okay. So that's built into us. So we grab onto what others around us are talking about. Now, to build on what the professor said, we particularly do that with people with whom we know, who we know and who we trust and with whom we identify. So you follow the people you follow on social media for a reason, and you don't follow others for a reason. There's in-groups and out-groups by your gender, by your age, by your politics, by your values, by your religion. We are in a bunch of different tribes, but it's self-selecting for what your tribe's talking about. And that bubble, right, becomes the magnifier for you. And let's talk about a different risk, right? Let's talk about climate change and nuclear power. It's a favorite topic of mine, right? Mm-hmm. So I follow a lot of people who talk about nuclear power, which it turns out is not nearly as risky as most people assume, because radiation isn't as bad for us as most people assume. But the people who are absolutely environmentalist in that tribe, and I'm one of them, kind of say nuclear power is bad because you're supposed to. And that's what the tribe says, and that reinforces that. And we want to be loyal to our tribe. So we enforce its views and discount information that goes against that views. And there's a lot of that, less so in coronavirus, but there's a lot of that and a lot of risk issues where our tribalism and our group loyalty causes us to accept or reject information that either offends or supports our tribe's views.
Sudeep, let me get you back in. Let me just throw out another psychological term, which is confirmation bias, which is our tendency to seek out the information that says to us, yeah, you're right about this. How does that factor in? And then I want to read some comments here, and I want to make sure we come with some solutions to what we've been describing here. But go ahead, Sudeep.
Well, yeah, absolutely. So confirmation bias, or let's say the confirmation tendency, it's not always a bias, because sometimes it's good to look for confirmatory evidence. But this really pertains to people, you know, finding or asking the questions that would essentially confirm their hypotheses. So instead of saying, you know, if you're someone who believes that you have a high risk of getting coronavirus, you could Google, what is the risk of getting coronavirus? You know, of course, an analogous Google search could be, what, you know, is coronavirus a low prop, you know, a low risk? So
using those, different language.
Different language. One casting coronavirus implicitly as a high risk thing that would then bring, you know, on Google a number of search results that confirm that idea, and the other doing the opposite. So this tendency, you know, again, it exists in everyday life. It's a key feature of our ability to reason about the world, and it certainly plays a very, very important role when it comes to how we look for information on news media and social media.
In fact, two emails, one from Jim, just a number of times I hear something or see something reinforce my belief in it. And Rick says, does the fact that we experience news in constant real time affect how we perceive risk? David, can I toss that to you?
Oh, yeah, perfect. Sure. So the amount that we hear about something absolutely burns it more into our mind. In fact, there's research that shows that even if there's a risk, somebody's claiming a risk that's phony. And so, you know, the people say that's a phony risk, try to combat it. The more they repeat that it's a phony risk, the more people who remember the risk remember, oh, that's a risk. Just amount of information. Absolutely. It remind me, what was the second question? Because it was related.
Well, it was related about just the sort of constant stream of news that people just hear all the time. I mean, as we're talking, I've got my TV on here. I haven't been watching it, but just there's the news, you know, pouring out of the TV.
So this gets to the solutions part of our conversation, if I can use that to segue for you, Marty.
Sure.
Okay. Don't be an information victim. Don't be a 24/7 information victim. Know that your mind only has so much attention space. Your risk radar screen has so much attention space, but not just risk, everything. Turn off the TV, read a book, take the dog for a walk, zone out, play solitaire online, whatever. Know that it is going to be bad for you. The purpose of our risk perception system is to keep us safe.
Mm-hmm.
We evolved an instinctive one, as the professor was suggesting. It can sometimes get us into trouble. One of the ways it gets us into trouble is if we overload one blip on the radar screen. Now that you know that, you can use that knowledge, you're welcome, David, to minimize that effect. Knowing how our cognition gets in the way of our safe decision making is a step towards avoiding its foibles. That's one good example.
Well, I appreciate that. And at the same time, I do think there's maybe this is a herd mentality or group thing, which is believing something as a group, even the thing that drives you crazy, can be a cohesive thing. Sudeep?
Well, actually, believing things as a group has all sorts of interesting psychology attached to it. So in groups, people are less likely to go against the group. But we know that you need a naysayer. You need the devil's advocate. In companies, in governments, you need someone to say, hey, what about this other alternative? Now, that's the case in groups. One could imagine having a similar devil's advocate in your own mind that looks at alternatives, that tries to essentially balance out the various perspectives. David also talked about a number of other ways in which we can sort of mitigate these incorrect risk perceptions. I think one solution is to actually think about the risky problem rationally. People don't have an immediate ability to do so, but we are certainly able, if we wanted to determine what the probabilities are to a rough extent, determine what the outcomes are, determine what the counterfactuals are and what we're missing out. So when you make a decision, say, not to take the train because you're worried about getting the coronavirus, I mean, take your paycheck into account. Take the additional maybe half an hour it'll take for you to drive, or the parking ticket or the parking fee that you'd have to pay. Now, once you put all of that into that calculus, maybe you'll come to realize that the risk mitigation by not taking the train does not really justify the increase in cost of driving or of doing the alternate way of getting to work.
But just, and the way I'd put that,
yeah,
if I
ahead,
can
Dave.
Interject, is know that your brain prefers to jump to conclusions. It's easier. It's easier than thinking hard. It's easier than going online. Your brain literally subconsciously likes to take a few pieces of information, run them through the filters of why that information is something you do agree with or don't, or you like or not, and come up with our feelings. But that can be a problem. So as Deep was saying, stop. Before you make a decision, come to your first conclusion. You're gonna. You can't not. But then stop. Stop. Literally know that jumping to conclusions itself could exacerbate the risk. Pause. And that pause alone lets your system two brain, your more rational thinking prefrontal cortex, get the facts brain, have a bigger voice, and then you'll make a better choice.
But how important, we're almost out of time here, but how important is trust? And I'm thinking the CDC has identified, I think, 13 cases as of this morning of the coronavirus in the United States of America. So let me toss this back to you, David. I'm sure there are people who believe that, but I'm sure there are people who do not believe what's coming out of a government institution.
Trust is a phenomenally important factor for whether we believe information or not, and therefore how much influence it has, how big the blip on the radar screen is, all the stuff we've been talking about. Let me switch to another example. There are people who are concerned about vaccines and their children. Some of the people who are concerned about those vaccines, and a small proportion of those are absolute non-vaxxers, but mostly they're just parents who want to do the right things for their kids, say, I don't trust the pharma industry. And that's literally the impediment to the information. So the challenge for pro-vaccine people like Paul Offit in Philadelphia and other people is to have more trustworthy sources doing the talking. And sometimes trust isn't expertise. It's just somebody in your neighborhood, somebody you like, your priest or minister or imam or rabbi. Trust does absolutely powerfully influence the power of information in our ability to use it in a reasonable way.
Sudeep, we got about 30 seconds. Final thoughts from you.
Final thoughts. Trust is important. Trust in institutions is important, especially if those institutions are competent. The World Health Organization, the CDC, these are all institutions that we should trust in. Sometimes we don't. That could be because of the institutions themselves getting weaker. It could be because of media sources that distort the priorities of these institutions. We can all think a little bit harder, get our facts straight, and make rational decisions if we want to, trust the right people, and that'll make us all better off.
Well, we're going to leave it there. Sudeep Bhatia, thank you for coming in. Thanks for joining us on Radio Times.
Glad to be here.
And he's a professor of psychology and marketing at the University of Pennsylvania. David Ropeek joined us by Skype. He's instructor at Harvard, a consultant in risk perception and management, and author of a book called How Risky Is It Really? Why Our Fears Don't Always Match the Facts. David, thanks for joining us as well.
Very fun. Professor, kind of nice to kind of meet you.
Kind of meet on the radio. Exactly. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out more about the program, including how to download a podcast of the show. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Thank you so much for joining us.